even more damaging than the Great Storm. But it passed without much remark, really. So in just 10 years, there's this big change in how a natural disaster is mediated to the public, and it produces all these kind of printed responses. As one of the earliest environmental catastrophes that could be quickly shaped into a national and international event by a sufficiently agile print media, the Great Storm of 1703 set a precedent for subsequent mediations of environmental catastrophes. These include the more famous reception of the Lisbon earthquake 52 years later, but also 21st century catastrophe discourses. It's widely understood in modern disaster studies that our cultural practices of describing, commemorating, and moralizing disaster creates our common sensibility for disasters and consequently determines what we see and how we act in a world ravaged by disaster and at an ever-increasing rate. That's Illner and Holm on the quotation on the slide there. But these practices of mediating and remediating disasters have a longer genealogy than is often appreciated. Despite obvious differences between early 18th century and 21st century conceptions of weather and climate, and obvious differences between a singular non-anthropogenic weather event like the Great Storm and anthropogenic climate change, despite these differences, the Great Storm texts share features and approaches in common with modern narratives of environmental catastrophe and climate change. So these written responses to the Great Storm ask a question that resonates today. If extreme weather is caused by humans' bad behavior, how can we effectively and ethically make use of that extreme weather to draw moral conclusions and moral lessons? So in this paper today, I'm going to look first at some of the sermons about the storm, which are more entertaining than they might sound, and then at Anne Finch's poem Upon the Hurricane. And what I want to do is apply some concepts from modern disaster theory to these texts, because for me, doing that has made visible some of the strategies in these older texts. So I think the theory can alert us to questions we might want to ask of these texts. So I want to apply this kind of modern environmental theory to these historic texts in order to better understand the texts themselves. And at the same time, reading these Great Storm texts can reveal some of the implications of these modern theories and modern disaster discourse. So in turn, these texts make visible some of the ethical and epistemological and even the theological and natural philosophical assumptions that underpin modern discourses of disaster. So that's what I'm aiming to achieve with this kind of methodology, this kind of mutual illumination. So as I say, first I'm going to look at some storm sermons, and I'm going to argue that these sermons construct a narrative of the storm in which the present, occupied by their listeners and readers, resembles the safe operating space of modern climate change discourse. This idea that the present is a period of respite in which moral lessons can be learned from past catastrophe and applied in order to prevent future catastrophe. So they present the storm as a turning point which creates a post and pre-catastrophic space in which people can act to change their behaviour and change the climate. Then I'm going to look at Finch's poem Upon the Hurricane, which contests the sermon's narrative framing of the storm. So for Finch, the opportunity to act was in the past and now is too late. So I read Finch's poem as a critique of the safe operating space idea, which is put forward by the sermons and by modern climate change deadlineism. So on to the sermons. The majority of sermons about the Great Storm, which made it to print, were preached a little bit after the storm itself on the 19th of January 1704, which was the fast day appointed by Queen Anne to commemorate the storm. So they're at a slight distance from the storm itself, their authors, these preachers, have had a bit of time to reflect on the storm, its possible moral implications, to gather a bit of intelligence about its effects and the destruction it wrought. They've had time to identify relevant Bible verses and to compose and later revise for publication their sermons. They all vary in tone and content, of course, but certain trends and features recur across the storm sermons. So perhaps unsurprisingly, they all invoke the punishment paradigm for interpreting the storm. They say God has sent this storm as a punishment for England, although they don't agree on exactly what England's sin was. And most of them are very hesitant to identify a particular moral cause for the storm. They talk very generally about atheism and corruption. There are a couple that do hint at sort of really petty, specific reasons that God might have sent this storm. My favourite one is a sermon which says, the storm was sent to punish people who mock clergymen, who make clergymen the subject of ridiculous buffoonery. So it's obviously written by a clergyman who had been teased a bit. But broadly, they refuse to kind of isolate and identify one specific moral cause. Another feature, a trend they have in common, is this portrayal of the storm as not an isolated event, but part of a series, a train and series in judgment, a longer series of calamities that stretched backwards and forwards in time. So they almost always list the Great Fire of London, sometimes the English Civil War, the Nine Years' War, the start of the War of the Spanish Succession, the plague, and several other large storms that had occurred in the 17th century. So different sermons list the great winds of 1636, 1661, and 1698. And this series sometimes also includes catastrophes in other countries, such as recent hurricanes in Jamaica and earthquakes in Italy. Now, when you combine these two ideas about the storm, this punishment paradigm with this idea of a train of judgments, a series of calamities, you end up with this third idea, that there is fair warning given. The storm could have been averted in the past, and further catastrophes can be averted in the future. So if human behaviour is the cause of these disasters, and God is sending them at intervals, he's giving us warnings to change our behaviour so that we can potentially avert the next one. So here are a couple of examples of how these ideas are constructed in the sermon. So that those last two quotations on the previous slide were from the Fast Day Sermon by William Harris, which is the first quotation there. It says, there is a train and series in judgments, connection and dependence among them. Every lighter judgment is a warning of greater judgments to come, and every greater calamity of impending ruin. There is fair warning given. And then we've got an extract from the sermon by Dualpede. I don't know if that's how you pronounce his name, but a lot of these preachers have really strange names. But Pede says, he's listing the different calamities that God has sent to England in recent years. He says, God gave commission to the destroying angel to execute his just judgments upon this part of the earth in bringing a grievous plague among us. And yet our inhabitants learned not righteousness as they ought to have learned. After that, he suffered the angels of darkness by the hands of their agents to lay our metropolis in ashes with an outrageous fire. And yet the inhabitants had so little care to learn righteousness that no sooner the fire was out, but they turned from their lesson. So we haven't heeded these warnings. And because we've carried on in our sinfulness, God has had to send this most recent catastrophe, the great storm. So the first point I want to make here is that one possible objection to analogies drawn between responses to the great storm and responses to modern climate change may be the seeming singularity of the storm. It was a dramatic weather event that took place over a couple of days, whereas climate change, of course, is a process massively distributed across time, decades, centuries, and millennia, rather than days or weeks. And climate change is punctuated, but not defined by single catastrophes like hurricanes. But what the sermons make clear is that the Great Storm was not perceived as this isolated event. The sermons insistently contextualize the storm in this train and series in judgments. So an extreme weather event has occurred and passed, but a climate of God's judgment and bad weather extended into the past and future. As both Harris and Pede make clear, these past intervals were missed opportunities to avert calamity. Our inhabitants learned not righteousness as they ought to have learned. The English could have heeded these warnings and things might have turned out differently. Perhaps the storm would not have come at all. The sermon by William Offaly makes this point explicitly. So Offaly says, God knows, had we, the sinful people of this kingdom, been so well disposed as to have made a religious use of that warning stroke which was given us at the first. So he says the first warning was the great wind of February the 7th in 1698, when the stormy wind fulfilled God's comment and punished us severely. It might possibly have proved a happy instrument to have warded off this second blow and inclined our God to have spared his people. But in fact, Offaly's is one of very few sermons to make this alternative history explicit. On the whole, the fast day sermons show little interest in pursuing this line of counterfactual speculation. They were produced, after all, 6 years before Leibniz's Theodicy in 1710, which really established and popularized counterfactual historiography. So there are a handful of moments when they say things could have been worse. One of them sort of imagines if London had been totally razed to the ground and says, you know, wasn't God good in not letting that happen? And we do have two sermons that were delivered the day after the storm. And they both sort of say, if you'd listened to my sermon last week, this wouldn't have happened. But broadly, the fast day sermons from a few weeks later, they place much greater emphasis on the special quality of the present, the post-catastrophic present, as an opportunity for reformation. So instead of contemplating what might have been, they focus their energies on shaping the future. So yes, we might have missed some opportunities to change things in the past, but we've got that opportunity now. So the hinge between possible outcomes that existed in the past is of less interest than the hinge between possible futures that exists in the present. And the sermons use all sorts of interesting imagery to create this idea of the present as a gap in that series and train of judgments. So Thomas Clapham talks about tender intervals of forbearance that are usual between one step and another. Creates this impression of God as sort of, you know, loving and tender. Whereas John Hoadley, I think, portrays God as sort of polite and courteous. So John Hoadley's sermon, the second quotation there, says, he bears with us only to give us time to return and be received. He grants us all that is needful to bring us to repentance. He bears with us and cuts us not off, but gives us time for it. Yet God has not forsaken us, but gives us at convenient distances notice of his impending vengeance. I really like that idea of God as sort of being very courteous, you know, giving you a convenient notice of his impending vengeance. And then the third quotation is from the wonderfully named Offspring Blackall. And he talks about the present as a period of rest or respite. He says, this we may be assured of, but unless we improve to good purpose the respite which God now affords us, we shall yet fall under a heavier condemnation than if we'd been called to judgment sooner. So by opening up this gap, this period of respite, the sermons make time or make space for people to act to bring about a better future. I've got a few more examples here. So the equally wonderfully named Increase Mather was a clergyman in New England. He's most famous for his connection to the Salem witch trials. So he's a very interesting character. So he was preaching in New England and he was concerned that the storm in Europe might foretell a similar one in America, in North America. So he wondered, who knows, but prayer may be a means, if not wholly to avert desolating judgments, yet to divert them for a time. Or as Thomas Bradbury says in his sermon, let us endeavour to break this succession of judgments. And the final example, I wanted to include one from one of the really bad poems about the storm, because I just find it funny. So this is S.W., anonymous poet, his poem on the late violent storm. He says, Christians be wise, let's all repent, that we our ruin may prevent. Let's turn to him whilst time we have, for there's no turning in the grave. It's such a bad poem. But it's got this idea that the threat of future catastrophe is critical and urgent, but the present in which these texts were composed, delivered, published and read is a safe operating space in which time we have to make a difference. The safe operating space is a concept in modern climate change discourse which I find useful for describing the sermon's narrative and temporal framing of the Great Storm. So this term was coined in two articles in 2009, an article in Ecology and Society titled Planetary Boundaries, Exploring the Safe Operating Space, and a shorter summary piece was published in Nature. And the authors of that article identified 9 planetary boundaries, quote, thresholds which, if crossed, could generate unacceptable environmental change. Although they argued that at least 3 of their boundaries had already been transgressed, they concluded that, quote, on condition that these boundaries are not transgressed for too long, humanity appears to have freedom to manoeuvre in the pursuit of long-term social and economic development. So in other words, let's carry on as we are, and even if we cross a few of these boundaries, we can just sort of come back if we do it quickly enough. Over the decades since, it's been harder to argue that we're still in a safe operating space when it comes to environmental change. Yet representations of environmental change still frequently depict a present with extra potential to change the future. This is Elizabeth Calloway's argument in her 2014 article, A Space for Justice. And she argues that in many scientific visualizations of climate change in particular, the present is the hinge on which everything hangs. So Calloway analyses the graphs used by the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and points out how the majority of these graphs either begin or end at the present. So there on the side is the famous hockey stick graph of global mean temperature, originally published in the IPCC's third assessment report in 2001. And of course, it derives that famous dramatic shape from that sudden upturn before the end of the graph at the year 2000. You also get a lot of commonly reproduced graphs which begin at or near the time of publication and represent multiple projections for the future. So that in that second picture on the slide is an example of that kind of graph. In both cases, the present is the space outside the graph, or at least at the sort of line on one of the axes. While the most recent IPCC report, the fifth assessment report from 2014, that does contain a handful of graphs that go from the past through the present into the future. But even in that report, most of the graphs, as well as other commonly reproduced visualizations of climate change, divide the past from the future. So the sermon's imagery of a period of respite that I was talking about perform a similar function to these graphs in presenting what Calloway calls the present as a moment of rupture. The implication which these graphs want to convey, according to Calloway, is similar to that which I attribute to the storm sermons. As Calloway puts it, if the potential in the present moment can be grasped, then maybe, just maybe, the present can be held open to make a space for justice. Comparing early 18th century sermons about a storm and 21st century graphs, radically different mediations as they are, we discover a shared aim to portray climate change in such a way that will inspire both terror and a belief in our capacity to change the course of events in this special moment that we've been afforded. Unfortunately, of course, in both cases, a practical program for what individual humans should actually do with this safe operating space they've been given is difficult to articulate, to say the least, when you know, the unwieldy sins of the nation or even greater structures are at least as responsible for the catastrophe, whether that's the great storm or climate change. So it might seem as though we've moved past this way of thinking in the last few years. We know that a lot of the planetary boundaries have been crossed and we're not going to be able to just nip back across them. Climate change is obviously is happening now. It's not something that will happen. But as well as graphs like these, we still see other popular forms of climate deadlineism that locate the tipping point in the near future and create the impression that we're still in a safe operating space now. The best known deadline is this idea that, you know, 1.5 degrees is the safe upper limit for global temperature rise by the end of the 21st century, which creates this impression that until we reach that point, we're in a safe operating space. And tipping points like these have the effect of shifting focus from what we've already done wrong, what bad things have already happened, to the worst things that are to come, but which can yet be averted by us. The Reverend Ferdinand Fina, preaching on 7th of January 1704, reminded his audience, who were Spanish merchants based in London, that they must not delay their reformation, quote, for it will be then too late. Now for Anne Finch, it was already too late. The deadline, the tipping point, had already passed. Finch completed her poem upon the hurricane in February 1704, so a couple of weeks after the fast day, although it wasn't published until 1713. Upon the hurricane is unique among the early responses to the storm in its temporal framing of this catastrophe. The poem disputes the idea of a safe operating space, this present moment of respite while God bears with us. Finch emphasises that the hinge between possibilities was in the past rather than the present. So Finch was a Jacobite. She had been a maid of honour to James II's wife, Mary of Modena, and supported the exiled Stuarts after the Glorious Revolution of 1688. She was a non-juror, which meant she refused to swear allegiance to the new monarchs, William and Mary. So she was effectively exiled to the countryside along with her husband. And in her poem, she drops some heavy hints that God sent the storm to punish England for deposing the Stuart kings. Now, James II had died in 1701, and a few critics have found evidence in her poetry that Finch was conspicuously unimpressed by the young James Stuart, his heir, the would-be James III. So from Finch's perspective, after 1701, things were pretty hopeless. England had committed its sin of deposing the rightful king, and now James II was dead. There was no way of undoing that wrong. The damage had been done. And the poem's approach to narrating the storm is starkly different from in the sermons. So the first half of the poem is constructed as a series of alternative histories, not in which God could have treated us even worse, and thank goodness he didn't, but in which the storm either didn't take place at all or its effects were mitigated. So Finch imagines this counterfactual history in order to kind of really stress what has been lost thanks to the storm. So she imagines the futures that all these trees would have had if they weren't blown down by the storm. They would have gone on to become great ships. And she imagines the harvests we would have enjoyed if all our crops and all our fruit trees weren't destroyed. And the most overtly political part of the poem, these lines on the slide, this also takes the form of a counterfactual history. So here Finch considers not that the storm might not have happened, but that we might have avoided a particular piece of the punishment. The Bishop of Bath and Wells was Bishop Kidder, who was killed in his bed in the Bishop's Palace, along with his wife, when the storm blew the chimney down upon them. Kidder had been made bishop in 1691 to replace Thomas Ken, because Ken, like Finch, refused to swear allegiance to William and Mary. So Finch suggests that if Ken had still been bishop, he would not have been killed. She says, "O Wells, thy bishop's mansion we lament, so tragical the fall, so dire the event." Then she says, but let no daring thought presume to point a cause for that oppressive doom. So she sort of says, let's not pinpoint a specific moral cause for this storm. But then she goes on to do exactly that. She says, yet, strictly pious Ken, hadst thou been there, this fate, we think, had not become thy share. Nor had that awful fabric bowed, sliding from its loosened bands, nor yielding timbers been allowed to crush thy ever-lifted hands or interrupt thy prayer. So even if the storm was inevitable, Finch suggests, we might have alleviated or mitigated its worst effects with particular actions like not getting rid of non-juring bishops. Near the end of the poem, Finch returns to that past time that preceded the storm with a striking image that encapsulates this sentiment that now is too late. She recalls how one day during the summer of 1703, the sun had turned a pale, dull colour and stopped shining brightly. It was, Finch declares, a portent of the storm, but she laments that nobody at the time was able to understand what this sign meant. Farther than we, that eye of heaven discerns, and nearer place to our malignant stars, our brooding tempests and approaching wars, anticipating learns, when now, too soon, the dark event shows what that faded planet meant. This passage raises the possibility that there was a point in the past when the storm could have been forecast and therefore potentially mitigated, if not avoided entirely. But if so, that moment passed too quickly. As soon as the danger is recognised, it's already here. This idea that the future is now, that it's come too soon, is a terrifying but familiar one to readers in the 21st century. As Ursula Heiss has argued, the name for our present, Anthropocene, has the, quote, capacity to cast the present as a future that has already arrived. Finch's poem is, in a way, a rebuke both to the fast day sermons and to the 21st century idea that we occupy a safe operating space. The dark event against which we guard, writes Finch, is now and should be confronted as such. Whereas the sermons occupy a present temporarily preserved from past and future storms, Finch's poem locates itself in a very sort of ambiguous temporal position in relation to the great storm, in order to suggest that the catastrophe is still ongoing. So her use of tense is very fluctuating. So for much of the poem, she talks about the wind in the past tense, how it flew and wrought destruction. But there are numerous shifts into the present indefinite tense, like there, now, too soon, the dark event, meeting now, the winds contend, and so on. In most printings, the ode on the hurricane is followed by a hymn in which Finch says that the wind's worst rage is over, and she's at least able to imagine a softer weather in the future. But now, you storms that have your fury spent, as you his dictates did obey, let now your loud and threatening notes relent, tune all your murmurs to a softer key, and bless that gracious hand that did your progress stay. So the hymn, at first glance, seems to occupy a safe operating space, or at least a safer space than was occupied by the ode. The storm is receding into the past by the time you get to the hymn. But the hymn does not suggest that the present is an opportunity to shape a future free of storms. The vision of the future that it offers is, and if that future times shall read my verse, though worthless in itself, let them his praise rehearse. So her praise is not said to bring about a better climate for these future times, but only to inspire future praise. So praise, worship of God, is not offered as a solution, as the sermons suggest it might be. It's just offered as a source of comfort, as a sort of retrospective appreciation that things could have been worse, and there's something of value that remains. So the hymn is looking for solace, not solutions. If we accept that the dark event is now, that recent catastrophes are not just preludes to an endlessly deferrable future, but are the reckoning itself that we feared, is there no time for action? If we reject the notion that we occupy a safe operating space in which we still have time to prevent the worst, whether that be another storm or a rise in global temperature above 1.5 degrees, are we left only with despair? This is the accusation often levelled at those who say it's too late to avert catastrophic climate change and its devastating effects. So it may be an ethical imperative to create space for hope, as the storm sermons do, as those various climate change deadlines do. But too lateness, Finch's poem suggests, is not the perspective that tempts us into a sort of complacent belief in total salvation. That's the false hope fostered by the safe operating space of the sermons. It is too late, Finch asserts, to remedy the sins which brought about catastrophe in the first place, and to avert a future filled with punishment for our sins. But it may not be too late to do the right thing, to do what little can still be done, which in Finch's view is to praise God, which in modern secular views might be to work for justice and kinship in a world that is and will continue to be ravaged by climate change. Real too lateness, in fact, by forcing us to abandon the hope for solutions or salvation, perhaps opens up more plausible possible futures, characterised by ongoing catastrophe, but also by a softer key, as Finch puts it. So comparing the varied literary responses to the Great Storm of 1703 reveals the importance of narrative framing in constructing our sense of our own agency in the face of environmental catastrophe. The storm sermons alert us to the particular worldview that underpins ideas like the safe operating space and suggest a theological route to this worldview. So that's a view that understands the human world to be directly responsive to human behaviour, but in a way that we can actually control. It assumes that the non-human world conveniently runs on the same temporal scales as human behaviour and human perception. It assumes that our action now can shape the immediate and near future, because that's the scale of causality that humans can actually perceive, rather than that future having already been shaped by our action in the past. Finch's poem Upon the Hurricane, on the other hand, offers a critique of portrayals of environmental catastrophe that overstate our present capacity to change our future course, and which focus on delusions of prevention rather than on this combination of lamentation and adaptation. Thank you very much. I'll stop sharing, I think.
That was really wonderful. Thank you very much. So if it's all right with you, I'd like to open the floor to questions. So if anyone has a question, you can unmute yourself and ask it, or put your hand up in the chat, or whatever means you'd like to use to say hello. Lots of questions from Tim Weiskill. Right. Go ahead.
So thank you so much, and I'm definitely going to go and look at those the 1636 New England, mediations of that storm and representations of that storm, because that sounds absolutely like an important precedent for certainly for what Mather's doing. So that's really helpful. Thank you. And this forensic hurricaneology, I had no idea about. That's absolutely completely fascinating. So just that, yeah, thank you for all those leads. I'm going to go follow. Absolutely. Thank you. That'd be wonderful. I mean, I'm in terms of making available, I'm sort of working this up into an article that I hope will be, out or before too long. Oh, that would be brilliant. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. I think, did Fiona have a question? Her box was lighting up in a strange way.
Oh, was it? Yes. No, I didn't
Yes.
really, but I will ask one now.
All right.
I
Sorry about that.
very much enjoyed that. I thought it was really, really interesting, Tess, so thank you very much. Can I be difficult and ask a couple of questions about what might be a difference between early 18th century sermon writing of the hurricane and maybe contemporary climate discourse? Because you just made such interesting, thought-provoking comments, and these parallels are really, really interesting. But I just wondered what you thought about a possible difference, because you suggested that was obviously a kind of religious outlook, and modern climate discourse is largely secular. So does it make a difference that for an early 18th century, late 17th, early 18th century writer thinking about the hurricane, there is an assumption that everything kind of depends on an omniscient creator, and also with the kind of the biblical parallels, analogies, typology. I mean, the apocalypse, if it happens, is the prelude to the second coming and a new heaven and a new earth. Now, that seems to me an aspect of contemporary climate change discourse and thinking about disasters that may not be there, and does it not make a very big difference to the narrative?
When you say disasters that may not be there, what?
Is that what I said?
Oh, sorry. Did, maybe
Sorry.
I heard the last your last point.
I think I might have broken it. No, what I'm saying is that to the narrative of disasters, it does make a difference to the possible future if you have a kind of biblical outlook about the apocalypse and the whole of time heading towards it, from a perhaps a modern secular outlook which doesn't have those sort of patterns, and so this the future's more uncertain. I don't know. As I say, I'm just being, difficult, really.
No, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm really fascinated by the kind of the punishment paradigm in older writing about weather and climate. And that, I mean, I think it's come back with a vengeance, because our conception of a climate that is effectively shaped by our sins, it's look can looks weirdly similar to a lot of these kind of, much older versions of weather. And if anything, I feel like there's a sort of blip of about maybe, from sort of 1750 to maybe 1950, when if you look, the only period in history when the punishment paradigm wasn't the kind of dominant framework for interpreting sort of extreme weather events. So I've been trying to kind of unpick, as you say, these kind of similarities or echoes. But I mean, you're absolutely right that the sort of intentionality of the divine narrative creates a difference. But I feel like there is a lot of, the apocalyptic narrative is absolutely prevalent in modern narratives of climate change, that we are kind of on this track towards, you know, a kind of this apocalyptic endpoint, and the sort of location of that intentionality gets shifted from either, you know, from the kind of this omniscient God to, I think, a sense of this kind of moralized nature, which is punishing us, you know, in a lot of sort of the more kind of popular mediation of climate change. And I think they have in common this idea that humans have some kind of control over the future, because the world is going to respond in this sort of logical and sort of anthropomorphized way to our behavior. You know, certainly in the sermons, you've got this kind of human-like character of God who is loving and polite and reasonable, and will, you know, if we just heed his warnings, he'll know exactly what we mean and implement the proper effects of that. And I feel like a lot of the, you know, the discourses we get now of, you know, if we just behave like this, of course the world will respond in a totally reasonable way and sort of take on board what we're trying to do. So I think you're absolutely right. There are these kind of huge differences that we need to account for. But then there are all these kind of weird similarities that, and I think I don't know how you would sort of evidence this, but it seems like it's just part of our kind of heritage of understanding the natural world, that we just haven't let go, regardless of how sort of secular we think we are. I don't know if that's really an answer.
Yeah, I think it's a very good answer and very, very important. So thank you very much. Now, I thought it was all very interesting.
Thank you. Tim has, I think, a follow-up question, but are there any other questions besides that? No, Tim, would you like to go ahead then? You're up, you lady.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you. I mean, the question of apocalypticism is definitely one that I'm going to have to address, and that, like, that question of intentionality that you raised as well, Fiona. There are, you know, all these really fascinating kind of lines of connection, and then we always have to kind of take that step back and think, what, you know, these things that look the same, but of course, are they? What kind of different forms are they taking? Can we really say that they are? How similar are they, or how much attention do we have to pay to kind of all these differences that emerge over, you know, the last few hundred years in how we figure things like the apocalypse? Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, 1703 is a fascinating moment in the history of sort of secular meteorology, you know. So you've got this, it's at this sort of point where people are starting to say a weather system isn't just the voice of God. It's this kind of logical thing that can be explained by scientific evidence. And the sermons are fascinating in the way they sort of pick up on, you know, they pick up on things, you know, of someone's barometer said this, but then they're sort of very anxious to sort of say that is the realm of speculation and faith in a way, because science can only go so far. It can't tell us where this storm came from. It's so clearly limited at the point where it is in 1703. And then they turn to, as you say, that belief system as if that is the place where we get evidence, you know, and the evidence is Bible verses. You know, this Bible verse tells us this, therefore that's how we interpret this storm, because that is that's the kind of reliable truth that we have, compared to this kind of scientific data that is totally unreliable. I find it completely fascinating. I didn't have time to get into this paper, but I always like talking about it, which is the eco-modernist movement that is sort of emerging now, where it's this sort of, you know, technology and capitalism will save us from climate change and so on. The sort of eco-modernists also call their movement Enlightenment Environmentalism, it's a gift to us, you know, anyone who works in the 18th century. So thank you to them for coming up with that. But it's a perfect example of, you know, these, as you were saying, the kind of supposed knowledge system. You know, we're all about technology. We're all about these kind of sort of incredibly anthropocentric kind of scientific solutions to things. But it's coming out of this absolutely kind of historically contingent conception of humans and the non-human world that they're certainly identifying the source for in the 18th century. I mean, what I've found really useful about these texts about the storm is the way they sort of work out the implications of some of these assumptions, like the safe operating space, or like the idea that it's too late. And they kind of experiments in, if you take that position, where do you sort of end up? You know, these are writers kind of working through these ideas. So I find them as sort of really useful sort of illuminations, as I was saying, of some of, if you follow this route, where do you kind of end up? Do you end up with a kind of hopelessness or a complacency, or, you know, where do you end up? And I find Finch's poem particularly useful in pursuing that line of, if you take the position that it's too late, do you end up with a kind of, you know, that kind of hopelessness? Well, there's nothing to do. What do we, you know, let's just carry on as we are and there's nothing that can be achieved. Or do you end up with that sort of, you know, that idea that we have to mourn and then adapt, but accept that we're kind of in this new state of things, which I think is where she ends up. And she kind of dramatizes that thought process, I think, in this poem. And I think that's what these sort of literary texts can do really interestingly for us when we're thinking about these modern debates about, you know, deadline, how useful are deadlines, you know, how do we kind of position ourselves in this narrative? Are we kind of in the middle? Are we too late? Are we too early? And these kinds of questions. I mean, that sounds absolutely, definitely need to go and follow that up. So thank you very much.
Thank you. We've actually got two other questions, Tara and Joshua. So I think Tara was first, if she wants to unmute and ask.
Hi there. Thanks for a really fascinating paper. I also work on kind of 18th century English literature, but my question is going to be a little bit different, because I was fascinated by the way you talk about kind of, say, Christian temporalities with regards to disaster, and I've been thinking about alternatives to that. So I've been listening to talks by Paul Hawken, who's head of Project Drawdown, which does a lot of work on kind of climate change solutions, and his sense of time seems to be more influenced by kind of Buddhist temporalities, kind of the idea that the cup is already broken, but you can act ethically in spite of what might be foregone conclusions. It might be too late, but you can still do the right thing anyway, kind of based on the idea that you have the right to your actions, but not to the fruits of your actions. And there have been lots of parallels drawn between this thinking and Stoicism as well. And I was wondering if there were kind of parallels in kind of 18th century England in thinking about agency and disaster without the overemphasis on control.
My kind of other main area of work is Georgic literature. Which has its kind of poetry about working the land, basically, based on Virgil's Georgics, which flourishes in the 18th century. That's kind of its heyday in English. And for me, that tradition is absolutely where 18th century writing about the natural world starts to touch upon these ideas. That, I mean, was it Paul Hawken, did you say?
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds like absolutely relevant. I need to go and look up. But that idea that you said about the right to your actions but not the fruits of your actions, I feel is a perfect kind of summing up of the sort of Georgic ethos that people often read as being obsessed with, you know, controlling the natural world and you know, asserting sort of authority over it. But in fact, if you know when you kind of look at both Virgil and the 18th century Georgics, they're absolutely they repeatedly make this point that, you know, you do all this work in order to try to bring about the effect you want, but it's absolutely not guaranteed, because this natural world behaves surprisingly, you know, diverges from what you predict. So I think that is one kind of tradition that is sort of running parallel to those, as you say, those sort of really Christian frameworks for reading weather, sort of everyday weather, and also sort of extreme weather and natural disasters and so on.
Mm. Yeah, that's really interesting.
That was that sort of alternative that you what sort of made me think of in the way you were describing Hawkins' work there.
Yeah, and with that Georgic material, are they thinking about, it sounds like it's more about thinking of climate in terms of something that is quite stable over time, even though you can't control it completely. So it seems to be quite different from the disaster material, which you mainly talked about today.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of precedented on that, you know, that the environment is sort of stable enough that we can use our past knowledge to tell us what we should do now, you know, when working the land. So yeah, it's kind of a Holocene genre in a way, Georgic, you know, because it has that sort of premise of that sort of cyclical, you know, predictable cycle, and yet it's always punctuated by storms and, you know, things that you can't forecast. I think it's kind of obsession with you know, needing to learn as much as you can about the natural world. You do that because it's so risky and dangerous and liable to do something unexpected. So I feel like there's kind of two strands to it, and I think, you know, Finch draws a lot upon Georgic in her poem Upon the Hurricane. She has a lot of kind of Georgic imageries of the harvest destroyed by the storm and so on, which come from Georgic poems, you know, especially Dryden's translation of Virgil's Georgics from a few years before. So I think writers still draw upon that as their sort of framework, their sort of generic framework for writing about extreme weather, as well as you say, those kind of everyday sort of seasonal weather.
Thank you. I really like the idea of Georgic as a Holocene genre.
Joshua, would you like to ask you a question?
Yes, thank you. Tess, thanks so much for this talk. Really fascinating perspective. And for me, as someone who studies sort of more contemporary climate change communication and politics. And so I was just thinking about sort of responsibility and agency, or as we might call the sin component. And when we're thinking about the planetary boundaries, obviously it sort of treats humanity as a whole, whereas of course there are particular actors, countries, and citizens who are more responsible for climate change than others. So I was wondering, in the literatures you're exploring, do they say that humanity is responsible as a whole, or are there particular actors or individuals who have caused this among sort of society?
Yeah, so different texts take slightly different approaches, but broadly they're really sort of self-conscious about that being a relevant question, you know. So certainly in the sermons they sort of say, you know, they explicitly kind of say we need to figure out whether this is the nation. So, you know, it's England, it's not kind of humanity, certainly at this point in when writing about the storm. Is it the nation, you know, is it the state, is it this kind of big sort of institution that we as individuals maybe have limited agency to affect, or is it the individual? And a lot of the sermons kind of explicitly make the argument that, you know, yes, these are kind of broader structural, societal and political issues that have, you know, caused God to punish us. But that is made up of your individual choices, you know, and if you make this individual choice to reform, to, you know, be a better Christian, then together we might be able to kind of bring about a larger change, or at least in the next storm, you won't be, God might spare you, he won't blow your house down, kind of thing. So that they're really anxious about how to make these connections, because they want to kind of make the argument for, you know, the sins of the nation often, but they also want to have this kind of effect on their listeners. So it's absolutely this problem of, you know, communication. How do you kind of bring about the effect you want in your listeners and sort of empower them to make a change as individuals while still acknowledging that what they do may have no effect? So I think that it's not really an answer, other than that they are really worried about that same relationship between the kind of large structure and the individual or the local community, and where you sort of apportion blame. And they're also very anxious to make that point that, you know, that the people who've suffered most, the people who lost their lives in the storm, weren't necessarily the sinful ones. You know, they sort of get really twisted in their logic to explain why God would maybe punish some innocent people but not punish really sinful people. It's because he really wants the sinful people to reform or whatever. So they're really kind of grappling with those questions.
Yeah, really interesting parallels. Thanks.
Thanks.
Right. I don't know. Do we have any more questions? I don't see any in the chat room. No. Right, well, let me give everyone a moment just to turn on their video if they like, and their microphones again, so we can all thank Tess for a wonderful paper and wonderful questions and answer session as well. Thank you very much. That was really, really fascinating.
Thank you very much, and thank you for all the great comments and questions. And I feel like I've got so much I can now go and look into and keep hopefully working on this and kind of and refining it and adding to it. So this has been incredibly helpful. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you so much for speaking to us. And keep an eye on all of our pages and whatnot for events for next term, because we'll hope to have at least one like this, like I said, again. So thank you all for coming, and thank you so much again, Tess.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Tess.
Thank you.